Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. All men are created equal. That according to the founding fathers who established the American justice system. Even so, that very system declares that some people are worth, literally, considerably more than others. In wrongful death suits, in dollars and cents, judges and juries determine the value of a life lost. More for some, less for others. It happens every day, without much ado, until now. Now, with so many dead in the wake of September 11th, the wrongful death appraisal process is getting a closer and more critical look. Consider this. Two people die in the Trade Center. One is a janitor, the other a banker. The government values one life at $400,000, the other at $4 million. Both individuals are dead, victims of the same terrorist attack. Each leaves behind friends and a grieving family. Usually each life is run through the actuarial tables, where factors include potential earnings and the possibility of lawsuits. But what about need? And what about the philosophical question determining the value of one life versus the other? This is unlike anything we have ever seen before. With so much private money, so much government compensation being offered at stake, is it or should it be considered something so different? Connection listeners, we're exploring the controversy and the question of compensating survivors of September 11. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. You can join our conversation online at theconnection.org. I'm joined today from a studio in New York City by David Liebrun. He is Dean of the Columbia Law School. On the line by Nancy Anthony. She's Executive Director of the Oklahoma City Community Foundation. And Stephen Push, who is Treasurer of the Families of September 11th Organization. And Stephen, I'll begin with you. Your wife, Lisa Raines, was killed on the aircraft that crashed into the Pentagon. My condolences.
Thank you.
All members of the Families of September 11th Organization, your organization, come at this from a perspective of such intense personal loss. I'm interested in hearing you explain how you pull it together, deal with this in dollar terms, in policy terms. It must be quite difficult.
We were presented with a fait accompli. There was an airline bailout bill that was passed on September 21st when all of us were still in shock and not aware of what was going on around us. When we started to recover from the shock, one of the things we discovered is that this bill had been passed and we had been prevented effectively from suing the airlines for this tragedy. So we are presented with a statute that states very specifically how the compensation fund will be administered. And now we're dealing with a set of regulations that the Justice Department has put out that deal with it quite differently. And for us, that's where the main problem lies, the disconnect between what Congress said and what the Justice Department is now saying.
And when you talk about the compensation fund, you're talking specifically about the money that's been earmarked by the federal government for families.
Specifically, the compensation fund that was created as part of the airline bailout bill to prevent the families of the victims from bearing the cost of the airline bailout.
David Liebrun, just a quick bit of law here, because Stephen talks about doors that were closed before people even knew that they were available. And I'm not sure how much of this is at this point cast in concrete. Are the families legally prevented from suing the airlines as they might under less catastrophic circumstances? I mean, the legislation is there, but does that mean the doors are closed and locked?
Well, the legislation doesn't close and lock those doors. The families are, in effect, given a choice between pursuing their ordinary civil remedies and electing to recover under the fund. But for a number of reasons, it's probably not a very good choice, including the overall limitation of the funds that will be available to those families. As I assume we'll explore later, the way the regulations at least work, some families, because of the deductions, won't be able to recover anything from the victim compensation fund. And those families and others may very well choose to pursue their civil remedies.
Now, Special Master Kenneth Feinberg, the fellow who was hired by the federal government to put this fund together, had to make some pretty tough decisions about how the money would be distributed. Stephen Push, the organization that he is with, they're saying that they're problems just with the way that it's been put together. But, David, does it follow court precedent in terms of helping people, not so much helping people, what's the word I'm looking for? Does it follow court precedent in terms of saying that this family is eligible for this amount of money, this family is eligible for that amount of money?
Well, I think I would have to say it doesn't really follow what would happen in a litigation. It might follow what would happen in a class action settlement where there's a little more flexibility. The problem with this fund is it is really functioning as a kind of hybrid. On the one hand, as a government fund, which looks to compensate these victims of this terrible tragedy according to their need, and as a replacement for tort litigation, which generally looks to compensate victims according to their loss. The regulations that the Attorney General has promulgated do neither of those, but rather attempt to strike a compromise between the two.
I've read the statute, and I don't recall seeing anything in the statute that said the families would be compensated based on need. The way I read it, they'll be compensated for their losses, both economic and non-economic.
I think that's correct. I think still there's a fair amount of leeway under the statute, but naturally people are disagreeing about the approach taken. Perhaps to focus on one specific thing, Ken Feinberg chose to limit the economic compensation to, in effect, a maximum income at the 98% percentage level. That is, he chose not to compensate victims who had losses based on income in excess of that which 98% of Americans earn. Certainly, that would never be an approach taken in tort litigation, but might make sense to taxpayers who feel that they've contributed these funds and don't want to see themselves in the business of sort of compensating the very highest income earners. That's a very basic policy dispute.
I want to take that a little bit further, but I do want to invite Nancy Anthony into the conversation. Nancy, you're, as I mentioned earlier in the program, the executive director of the Oklahoma City Community Foundation. And I know I've read a couple of comments of, family members of people who lost relatives in the Oklahoma City bombing who were saying, you know, September 11th remains an unprecedented event, but what does that mean for the people, the family members we lost?
I think that's right. I think that part of it is looking at the action of the government providing the compensation as opposed to the reason for the government providing the compensation. As was said earlier, the airline bailout bill was the reason for the compensation, although I think most people don't necessarily make that connection. So it appears as though, at least to many people in Oklahoma City, that the government, because of the nature of this tragedy, seems to be willing to give some kind of compensation to those people who were victimized because of a act against the federal government, where, in fact, that same thing happened in Oklahoma City. It was not only an act against the federal government, it was in a federal building. So there's obviously to tell them that it's only because to keep the airlines from being sued doesn't really make a lot of sense to them, because their loved ones are just as dead. They have gone through exactly the same scenario as the people in New York, yet no one has stepped forward to try to help them in as significant a way. Obviously, there was a significant amount of charitable assistance, but in Oklahoma City, the charitable assistance was almost entirely need-based. So for some family members who did not have economic dependence on people, there wasn't a whole lot of money that flowed to them at all, and nor was there anyone to sue for what happened.
I imagine that this has to be a part of the conversation, Stephen, when members of the families of a September 11th get together.
Well, we're very much aware of the fact that the creation of this fund has created questions in the minds of other terrorism victims as to why they haven't gotten this funding. But as Nancy pointed out, the reason for this fund is not primarily to help the families. It's primarily to help the airlines. And but then Congress realized, after they decided to help the airlines, that it wasn't fair to expect the families of the innocent victims to be the ones to bear the cost of that bailout.
David Lieberman, at this point, and I know it's very early, a number of or very few families have signed on to the compensation plan offered by the federal government. Is that an indication that it's not likely to work in its present incarnation?
No, I don't think we know yet. It's still very soon for families which have suffered such a severe loss. I think those families want to see what their situation is, consult their advisors, including legal advisors. One of the aspects of this fund is when you do apply, not when you receive the money, but when you do apply, you in effect waive your right to file a civil claim. So families should be very, very careful about their decision to apply to the fund for compensation. So, and I believe there's a 2-year limit on applications once the final regulations are promulgated. So it makes sense to take some of that time for the families to carefully review their situation, decide which course of action is best for them.
Many families are waiting to see what happens with the first few cases, to see what size of awards are granted. Unfortunately, what that means is that the people who are going into the system first are the people who are so financially strapped that they have to accept a $50,000 advance payment that the government is offering. Once they accept that payment, they waive their right to sue, and they're going to be, unfortunately, the guinea pigs who are going to demonstrate how fair this fund is going to be.
So Stephen, when you say people are watching those first few families, is it about the dollar amount? Is that really what it comes down to, that people are saying, look, this is significantly less than we would get in a courtroom, this is less than my family requires to continue? Is it about the amount of money or the way it's put together?
It's about a lot of things. There are a lot of emotions involved here. I think a lot of the concern that the families have has to do with the way this was introduced. But the bottom line is that the compensation that's being offered is substantially less than what people felt they were promised when they read the statute.
All right. Connection listeners, if you have thoughts on this, you know what our number is. It's 1-800-423-8255. Stephen's saying the bottom line is that the compensation that was promised or that looked like it was being promised is significantly less. Just briefly, Nancy, I'm interested in your perspective. Should it be, is this a precedent that the government has to be worried about?
Well, I would think so, just because of the fact that when Oklahoma City happened, no one thought that anything would ever happen again, and in fact it did. So I think you have to think in terms of things like that happening again, and so that precedent is out there. I think that, let me just also say that in Oklahoma City we went through a process of arresting someone and trying two different people over and then finally executing someone that went off for about a 6-year period of time, and there was a trial and there was all kinds of involvement. Very different perhaps than a lawsuit, but yet still something that did not allow people to get some closure and continue on with their lives. And
okay,
I think one of the issues is
we're going to be back
that.
With a little bit more of this. We have to take a short break. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. This hour we're talking about the awkward question of determining the value of lives lost in the September 11th tragedies. What about the philosophical questions determining the value of one life over another life? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest, David Lieberman, Dean of the Columbia Law School. Stephen Push is Treasurer of Families of September 11th. Nancy Anthony, Executive Director of the Oklahoma City Community Foundation. Nancy, I cut you off just at the end. You want to complete that thought?
Sure. I was just going to say I think that there's a significant psychological cost to going ahead and continuing on with things into the future for a long period of time, and it keeps people from ever getting closure and continuing on with and trying to figure out how they're going to live the rest of their lives. And so I just think that at some point in time, you have to weigh the money against how long is this thing going to drag out? And we certainly had that happen in Oklahoma City, not because of money, but because of trials. But it does provide some significant psychological cost to people.
Right, and some guidance. 1-800-423-8255. Jeff's calling in from Idaho. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
Hope you can bear with me a little bit, but there's a point I'd like to make, and I think I have a good argument behind it. I believe that, yes, all men are created equal, but we all don't end up that way. And this is how there's a couple things I'd quickly like to say. We, every day as a society, make that judgment call. We have people who are on death row. And as a society, we have said their life is not as much value as the normal guy that's walking the street. But this is a financial issue. And where do we place the value of the hard work that a lot of those people who passed away, there are some that put in years and years and years to get where they were so that they could financially be responsible. And if we make it an even playing field, we invalidate the hard work that they put in to get their PhDs or their bachelor's or their master's degree or the years that they put in to become and have that potential that they did have to earn a living for their families and for their dependents and for themselves. Now, I think as a nation...
But Jeff, are you putting a value on the amount, the number of years they put in their given profession, or are you talking about their earning potential here?
I think their earning potential, no matter what it is, because there are some people who haven't gone to college and have a huge earning potential because they put in 12-hour days for 10 years. Now, I think as a nation, we got behind everybody and showed everybody who lost people there that it was a terrible thing, it was a sad thing, and as a nation, morally and ethically, we're behind them and say, yes, the loss that you feel is just as deep and just as significant as the loss as everybody else has felt, but this is a financial issue, and it's a difficult issue, and I think those people who are making the decisions have made some tough, hard, but wise decisions, saying that, well, and I don't mean to disparage anybody in this, but a man who's 26, 27, and is starting out as a janitor isn't going to make as much over the next 30 years as someone who is maybe 36, 37, and a vice president, because they have decided to do different things and have put in different amounts of effort and work, and their families and dependents shouldn't be penalized saying, well, we're going to take away from us so that everybody can have a little more.
Let's ask Stephen Push to just speak briefly about whether or not there's any kind of unanimity at the families of September 11th that one life based on whatever might be worth more than another.
The call has an interesting point. Under the statute provides for both economic and non-economic damages. Economic damages, by definition, are going to be unequal because different people had different earning potentials in their lifetimes. But the non-economic damages for pain, suffering, and for loss of companionship and things like that, people, rich or poor, suffer the same when they lose a loved one. And so that should not be based on the person's income. And one of the problems with the regulations...
But it's not, isn't it, Stephen? I thought that there was a base figure of pain and suffering.
Well, the problem with the Justice for Smart regulations, one of the many problems, is that they tremendously discounted the non-economic damages. They're only paying about one-tenth of what would be paid in a comparable case. And because the non-economic damages are the ones that are equal across all income levels, that has exacerbated the distinction between the people who get the least money and the people who get the most money.
Let's ask David Lebron if there might have been another way of doing this that would be more equitable.
Well, there certainly would have been another way, although I think given that there's a limited fund, some compromises are going to have to be made. And the question is in which direction you want to move it. Do you want to move it in the direction of one kind of equality, which sort of says simply all lives are worth roughly the same and people suffer the same amount, and one could have increased the non-economic damages, say, from $250,000 to $500,000 or $1 million. Or one could move in the other direction. I think the caller does, Jeff, does have a very good point, but there are two kinds of equality. There's this simple kind of equality that says everybody's equal, everybody gets the same treatment, every life is worth the same. And there's a different kind of equality which says we have a set of rules and principles and we apply that equally to everybody. We replace everybody's lost income based on their earnings. That's also a kind of equality. And what the special master did here was strike this compromise between the two by limiting, I think, fairly severely the non-economic damages, for my taste, probably a little too much, but also limiting the economic damages with this cap based on, roughly speaking, $231,000 of annual income. So if you made $500,000 a year, in effect, $269,000 of that income does not count toward determining your award. So the special master sought to accommodate both concerns. With a limited fund, that is not enough money to compensate everybody the full measure of the damages they might or might not have been able to receive in civil litigation, we're going to have to compromise on one or both of those two measures.
All right. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Jeff, thank you for your call to Lowell, Massachusetts. Kevin's joining us now. Hi, Kevin.
How you doing?
Good,
hey,
thanks.
I just had a quick comment. I donated money to the funds, and I was a little upset with the way they're going about distributing it. It was an emergency situation, and I had that in mind when I gave the money. You know, I don't want to pay for people's yachts and their summer homes. I wanted to take care of the people who needed money right at that point for food, clothing, basic transportation to get back and forth to work for families that, you know, members that survive.
So, Kevin, are you saying that the money, that the families of September 11th should not be getting money from the federal government because there was so much money donated by private citizens at that time?
Well, no, not at all. But it shouldn't be based on what their income was. I mean, that should be stuff to be dealt with later on by, you know, lawyers and courts or whatever. But these emergency funds, it seems like there's all kinds of problems with the way the money's getting distributed. The richer people want more, you know.
And so what you're saying, it should be just the same amount to everyone.
Right, for the emergency funds, absolutely.
Well, the emergency funds are based on need. And, wealthier people should not be getting those funds, and I don't think they are. But there's a couple of points I'd like to correct. First of all, this is not the Victims Compensation Fund. It's not a limited fund. There is no limit to it, and essentially Congress gave the Justice Department a blank check. It's the Justice Department that has chosen to limit it the way it has. The other thing is the income cap is not the only reduction in the economic damages being paid. That's the most visible one and affects the wealthy, but actually they've reduced the economic damage awards for everybody across every income level. For example, a New York City firefighter, they have reduced his lifetime earnings growth by 20% in calculating the award. And for the financial professional in the World Trade Center who died, they're reducing that person's, the cap aside, they're reducing that person's future earnings growth by 50% through the use of outdated or inappropriate actuarial data.
Nancy Anthony, how in your perspective, or actually in the work of the Oklahoma City Community Foundation, do you make those awkward, difficult determinations about need?
Well, need is, you just try to look at, we tried to look at in Oklahoma City, what is it going to take for somebody to begin to restore their life and move forward? And I think that was a very important, it was obviously a value judgment on our part, but we felt like that our goal and what we wanted to be judged by was, when we got finished, did most people have an opportunity to begin to live their life in some kind of an independent fashion? So we define need based on people's ability to move forward and what did it take for that to happen. Now, again, that's a definition, but it did achieve something in our minds, which was an opportunity for people to be able to live their lives in the best way that they possibly could in spite of what's happened to them.
All right, Kevin, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Pendleton, Kentucky. Glenn is joining the conversation. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thank you.
My comment or question might seem a bit insensitive to some, and I'm sorry if people are hurt or offended, but I think there's a side to this issue that's a bit more foundational, and I haven't heard or seen it debated anywhere. It has nothing to do with how you value different lives, but rather, should the government be compensating people for dying at all?
If it takes away their right to sue, isn't it obliged in some way to make some sort of compensation there, Glenn? Because that's, in effect, what Stephen was explaining.
Well, perhaps. The issue is a bit more complicated with that. Nevertheless, there are almost there's a whole lot of citizens in this country that really aren't being given a chance to vote on this issue. I think it sets a bad precedent. People die every day. I've had deaths in my family in the last several years, and no one has offered me compensation for that. So, all insensitivity aside, I really don't feel like it's the government's place to be dispersing my funds in this way.
I would go further and say to set the bad precedent. I would say that the way this whole bailout was handled and the compensation fund that was necessitated by it, this should be used as a case study of how not to do it in the future.
David Liebron, why?
Yes.
What would have happened if the federal government had not limited people's right to sue the airlines? I mean, it's been suggested that it might be kind of an awkward suit, you know, that whether or not, in fact, you could claim that it was the airline's fault. What if, as Glenn appears to be suggesting, we just let the private sector deal with this, and if American Airlines goes out of business, another airline will come along and fly people around the country?
Well, it's not even clear American would go out of business. It might be, as in the asbestos cases, for example, that the victims end up being the owners of the airlines, which continue to fly, but the earnings, in effect, go to compensate them. I agree with Stephen and the caller that this probably is not a very good precedent, and I go back to my original point. I think no matter what we say, there are these two conflicting goals of the government serving in its usual role of taking care of people in a time of need and replacing these tort suits. And those two goals are not going to sit comfortably together. Somebody is going to look to one purpose or the other and be very unhappy with how the government goes about it. If we had left it to the private litigation, there would have been a lot of litigation against these two airlines. It might have put them out of business or put them into bankruptcy. These are very difficult cases, one has to say, at the beginning. There are a number of different cases that might be brought. But the cases against the airlines are difficult. That's not to say they couldn't be won, but it's also far from clear that they would be won. And so what this fund does is give the victim something sure and something quick in place of something that would take a long time and stands on uncertain legal ground.
Glenn, just quickly back to you. You talk about it as a bad precedent. Do you think that if money goes to the families of the victims of September 11th from the federal government compensation fund, that from now on forever, people will be able to make claims like that against the government?
I don't know if people will be able to make claims and win claims, but I think they'll be brought.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255 to Boston. Irene, you're on The Connection. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to put my two cents worth in. I'm extremely uncomfortable with the government acting in the position of an insurance company. I would like to see a flat amount given to every estate of every person that was killed in the bombings. $500,000, whatever number you come up with, give everybody the same amount, period. That's the end of the government's contribution. And I think the government should then also give the same amount to the Oklahoma City bombings and the two embassies that were bombed in Africa.
And the people on Egypt Air? Far back do we go?
That's part
of the problem here, isn't it?
No. Egypt Air was an issue that has not been resolved. I'm saying that where there is a bombing against a government or financial institution, the three of them were government buildings, and the fourth one was the World Trade Center, which, it's debatable what it is or isn't. And I think that should be the absolute end of the government's involvement in the matter. The government does not have the right to take away people's right to sue. I think it would be healthier for the industry, for the airlines, for everybody, if people could make their own choice. I think that
the business of saying that that person's earning potential equals X, therefore...
That's an insurance company's business. That's not the government's business.
There's another issue with suing, too. I did want to sue the airlines before I knew about this bill, but I didn't want to sue sue the airlines for the money. I wanted to sue the airlines
for the principal.
For the principal, and to send a message to the other airlines that when they sit in a management meeting and they talk about cutting back on security to improve their profit margin, that they think twice next time.
That's right. And I think that the government saying we have something to give citizens that are the victims of terrorism is one thing, and then let the people who choose to proceed with that message proceed with it. I also have a serious problem with the government bailing the airlines out because the airlines still haven't fixed the security problem.
And that's the point of punitive damages, isn't it,
well,
David?
That's right.
I think that is a good point. If the government steps in to relieve enterprises of their obligations in cases where they engaged in negligent behavior, that's a disincentive for them to take that measure of safety precautions. And in cases where it's determined that actors have behaved particularly egregiously, punitive damages are imposed. Again, whether they would have been obtainable in this kind of case is somewhat a doubt. It should also be said, I think, I don't know if this is part of Irene's point, but this is a case in which we might also say the government had some measure of responsibility. The government has an important measure of responsibility in our security, particularly against terrorists, and therefore this and other terrorist cases might be distinguished from other kinds of losses where we wouldn't expect the government to step in.
It's interesting in Oklahoma City that there seemed to be no one to sue except the federal government, and I think that there was certain immunity there that prevented that from occurring.
You can't sue the government.
That's correct.
When
so if you have additional cases like Oklahoma City where there is no one to sue, then what in fact occurs? I mean, it's just an interesting question.
No, it's a very interesting question, and we'll pick it up when we come back. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the some of those difficult issues that are coming up concerning compensation for the families of victims of September 11th. We're interested in hearing from you on that. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. We're talking about the issues surrounding compensation for the families of September 11th. My guests are Stephen Push. He is treasurer of an organization called Families of September 11th. Nancy Anthony is executive director of the Oklahoma City Community Foundation. And David Lebron is dean of the Columbia Law School. Our number, 1-800-423-8255. And we're going straight to Louisville, Kentucky. Ken's on the line. Hi, Ken.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show. I just want to make one quick comment about the fact that from everything I've seen on television, the insurance or the trade tower, or the World Trade Center, the airline industries and everybody involved with this tragedy were seriously underinsured for something of this magnitude. Now, in light of that, I think one way or the other, the federal government was going to have to step in and bail somebody out, whether it be up front trying to deal with the families or on the back end trying to bail out either the airline industry or the way that we're going to be helping to rebuild New York. I think overall, the way that they set up the formula based on earning potential or based on what the person was making, because some of the higher potential earning potential victims, they did have, or most of them, I'm sure, had huge insurance policies to help protect against something like this. And I don't think they would leave themselves exposed. Whereas somebody making $30,000 as a janitor would have much more to lose.
Are you saying, Ken, that it would have been better for the government to just give the money up front and as it's hoping to do, or that it might have been better for the government to say, all right, let's let this go through. Let's let the trials and the punitive damages all take place. And if the government then has to give some money to an airline or to a World Trade Center tower organization, then that's the way it should be done then.
Well, I think it's better to do it up front because, for the first thing, I think the families will get relief a lot quicker. The other problem is if you bankrupt the airline industry or you bankrupt a state. I mean, if you look at everybody that could theoretically be lifted in a lawsuit for this, it'll end up, you know, as people go bankrupt and companies start going out, you know, instead of getting, and again, I don't know the hard numbers on what everybody's going to be getting, but instead of getting a dollar for a dollar, it could be a nickel on a dollar.
Right.
You know, and it could be 10 years down the line before it's resolved.
Okay. Ken, thanks for your call.
Okay.
Stephen, I mean, one of the parts of the conversation that is always vague is money that came from the private charities, the large ones, the small ones, you know, offers from the Salvation Army to cover the bills of the families who were involved there. In terms of that Ken was talking about, getting the money to the families right away, immediate need, is that really there in this case?
I think that was there. I mean, the level of giving was in this situation was unprecedented. Now, the level of need was unprecedented too, but still, it was very encouraging, and we're very grateful for the tremendous support we've received from the public. And even though there were and still are some substantial problems with how the charities have been handling the money, you know, the efficiency with which they've been carrying out their jobs and some of the confusion with having 240 charities all with different missions participating in this, nonetheless, I think by and large, most families' basic needs are being met, but that's only designed to you know, tide them over for a few months, and it's the compensation that comes either from the government compensation fund or from successful litigation that's going to make these families financially whole again.
Nancy Anthony, you're in the business of gathering money from institutions and private sources and making sure that it goes to the proper people. Are you concerned at all that in the weeks and months of coverage that we're going to see of these issues and these problems coming ahead, that maybe some of that will dry up as people say, "Nah, let the government deal with it"?
Well, I think that is probably very much a case. I think a lot of the complaints in the level of dissatisfaction that seem to be expressed in New York will have an impact the next time around on how people choose to give and to what kind of organization they choose to give. I think, in fairness to the charities, let me say that most charities don't have as their mission collecting money and dividing it up and handing it out. They have as their mission trying to help people. They were given a group of people to help in this case,
right,
in many cases was very different than their normal group of people, and so they had to try to redefine how that help would be given. So in fairness to them, we asked them to instantly do something different than they had ever done before, and just as the government wasn't able to do its job instantly, I think it's not fair to expect the charities to have done it instantly.
But I think there's a way to, I think we can learn a lesson from this that can help people in future disasters. I think there are two things that could be instituted that could make a difference. One is a universal claim form that all charities that respond to disasters will honor. And the other is
whether it's a hurricane, whether or not it's a fogged in highway and a bunch of cars pile up?
It doesn't matter. People have basic needs. They have bills they have to pay. They have certain expenses they have. The charities have certain missions. You know, some will pay your mortgage. Some will, you know, some will provide food and shelter. And you have a single form that has all the information that all the charities need. The claimant fills out a single form. It can go to, you know, all the charities, and they can, you know, the ones who, you know, who can identify a need that they can fill will fill it. The problem here is that people had to fill out dozens of forms and make hundreds of phone calls to get the assistance they needed. The other thing that I think could be very helpful is to have teams of caseworkers who could do outreach to families. Basically, what happened in New York, if you couldn't get into Pier 94, you had real problems. And there are some people who can't do that. So if they're caseworkers, they could go out and help people, you know, find them, find out what they need, help them fill out the forms. That would have made a big difference.
In Oklahoma City, those things actually did happen, probably within the first 2 months for sure. So there was a significant outreach, intentional, with case managers, as well as there was an effort. There wasn't a single form, but there was an effort to make sure that if information was gathered by one agency, it was honored by a second.
But the question is, if you could figure that out for Oklahoma City, how come it didn't happen on September 11th?
Okay. David wanted in here.
If I could jump in, I think, with 2 points. One, in New York, the legal community in particular has responded to help generally without any cost, law schools, City Bar Association, and others to make available their expertise in helping victims sort through this very complicated thicket. The other point I really wanted to make is I think people are going to be rethinking how to allocate charitable dollars in the wake of all this. We had the plane to the Dominican Republic, which went down with the families of many people who were not well off, and there wasn't the same kind of response to that. We do tend to respond to shock and disasters in particular, but I think the lack of coordination in a situation such as this, the debacle with the American Red Cross, is going to get people to think much more carefully about who is in need of their contributions the most.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. Ken, thanks for your call to Mark in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Mark.
Hi, I have a couple of comments based on what I've heard so far in the program. And one would be considering, I guess, the value of payment and whether or not there should be equality. And I've heard today about a janitor versus, say, a PhD. And as someone else commented, I think it's important to consider that someone who has a higher income has several options available to them to invest for insurance and things like that in terms of protecting their family. Because, indeed, we all know that life is a risk. And whether it would be a car accident or some other means, there's always a risk that the breadwinner may no longer be available to pursue income opportunities. And I also, as I listen to this, I've thought about, having been in the military myself, that as best I recollect, someone in the military who dies would get $100,000 in insurance. And so the people who are actually out risking their lives to defend this country, that apparently is the value that's been placed upon their life and that type of service. So I think maybe there is some consideration there in terms of maybe what's appropriate and what's not appropriate.
Do you think there's a little resentment there, Mark, among people who would qualify for less than what we're talking about here?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Just whether or not, if for example, you had a brother who was a soldier and was killed and got $100,000, and you're reading in the newspaper that someone in New York might get $6 million, is that, you know, that people just build resentment over that?
Well, I just think it's maybe important to consider that, again, that I think we always want to blame somebody, and then we always want someone else to be responsible. And I think in a situation such as this, and I'm just using the example of the military as saying that the people that we know are in harm's way, this is what our government is providing for them.
Right. Okay, thanks for your call.
I agree with Mark. One of the things that I've learned from this tragedy is because my wife died in the plane that hit the Pentagon, I've had an opportunity to meet a lot of military families. And I was appalled at the way, at how poorly the families of military who die in the line of duty are treated. I think we need to do much more for them, and it's one of the issues I'd like to work on in the future.
All right, to Medford, Massachusetts, Jean. Are you there, Jean?
Yes, I am. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. This may be a little bit off track, but it has been brought up, and I just wanted to address it. The idea of suing the airlines kind of perplexes me a little bit, and I'll tell you why. When those terrorists went through security, they, in fact, were carrying items that were perfectly legal at that time. And those things were approved, you know, obviously, by our government, the FAA. I also feel that if anyone were to be sued, wouldn't it be the government for the lack of keeping track of these terrorists?
But you can't sue the government, Jean.
Okay, well, my question then is, why the airlines?
I've talked to a couple of lawyers about this, and I was not told that you couldn't sue the government. What I was told is you can sue the government, but you can only sue the government for making a mistake. For example, if in the case of letting terrorists run around the country, if they have a policy of allowing people on the terrorist watch list to enter the country, and that's their policy, you can't sue them.
David, is that right?
No, it's a little more complicated than that. There's certain kinds of mistakes you can sue the government for.
Give me an example.
Well, when a postal truck runs through the light, I guess the post office is no longer separate, is a separate entity now. So a government truck runs through a red light, and a green light rather, and knocks down a pedestrian. You can sue the government for that. You can sue the government for very specific acts, not implicating policy decisions, not implicating general decisions. You can't sue the government for letting the wrong person come in the country. These would be very difficult cases, either against the government or the airline. Yet it should be said that, in general, the fact that these items were legal doesn't necessarily get the airlines off the hook. I think the case against the airlines would be very difficult, but not impossible. Of everything that I've seen out of this terrible tragedy, probably the mistake that produced the most potential liability was the announcement in Tower 2 of the World Trade Center that people should go back to work. That's an example of a specific, arguably negligent mistake that might lead to recovery in a tort case. The case against the airlines is possible. They maintain responsibility for assuring the safety of their aircraft and preventing people from coming on with dangerous implements. But the plaintiff in such a case would have to prove negligence, and that's a difficult claim, even in this case.
Nancy Anthony, it's been, what, 5-6 years since the Oklahoma City bombing. I'm wondering, from your perspective, are we learning anything as we make it past the awful tragedy that you went through past September 11th?
Well, it's sort of interesting to see that in many cases the pattern of things, not only within the general community but within individuals, is very similar. And there's a very significant grieving process that many families are going through. And much of what happens and much of the anger that's out there, and that's going to be expressed through their reaction to different kinds of things, different whether that's charities trying to help them or the government trying to settle things, is that there's a natural anger that exists out there. And I think everyone needs to understand that's part of the grieving process. And as people get over that, then in fact they will have perhaps a different approach or a different attitude about what's there. At some point in time, everyone, or hopefully, will get to the point where they say, how do I begin to move forward and get beyond this? And that will be difficult as long as there are issues out there that kind of continue to keep them being angry. And unfortunately, money and compensation is one of those issues, and that seems to, I think, oftentimes make things worse rather than better.
Thanks to all of you for being with me this hour.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
David Lebron is Dean of the Columbia Law School. Nancy Anthony, Executive Director of the Oklahoma City Community Foundation. Stephen Push, Treasurer of an organization of families of September 11th. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation. Go to our website, theconnection.org. We had help with our program today from Dara Manoogian, Tim Monroe, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Sugart. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.